You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, are you a Felicity, a Kirsten, a Samantha, a Molly, or a Josefina? That's a common question among fans of the American Girl line of books and dolls. The brand was founded by Pleasant Roland in Wisconsin back in the 1980s, went on to become an icon of girlhood for many in the 1990s and 2000s. Beyond the dolls and books, American Girl turned into a kind of lifestyle brand for young girls, including, but not limited to, theater kits, recipes, paper dolls, a magazine, and advice books on health and friendship. Our next guest hosts a podcast that revisits the American Girl series through a historical lens. They've just co-authored a new book exploring what they call the wonderful and wild world of American Girl fandom. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have an American Girl doll when you were younger, or did your kids? Did you especially relate to any of the characters or their stories? What kind of influence has American Girl had in your life, in your family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney are historians, co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast, and co-authors of that new book. It's called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. Allison and Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mary, let's start with you. You say in the podcast, in the book, that you're a total Molly. Now, for people who aren't familiar with the American Girl lineup, we're pretty familiar here in Wisconsin, but tell us a little bit about how you connected to one of the particular American Girl characters.
Sure. So I received Molly when I was 9 years old on Christmas Eve. So she was the first American Girl doll I'd ever heard of or met. And she lives during World War II. And I just was so fascinated by her books. I was always more of a fan of the books than dolls in particular. But really, for me, what made Molly my favorite was that she kind of, her stories functioned as a bridge to one of my favorite people in my life, my grandmother, who I'm named after, who I affectionately called Fluffy, who, you know, didn't read the books, but because I could ask her lots of questions about growing up during World War II and if she had a victory garden and things like that.
And Allison, you are also a longtime Molly. What led to that connection for you?
So my story is actually really similar. I also received a Molly as my entry point into the American Girl brand, but her stories were something that just really fascinated me. I loved to kind of step inside someone else's life, and I was very jealous of her bangs and her eyewear. So I did try to kind of facilitate the eyewear piece by just like failing an eye exam. That was not successful. Now I don't have to try. I fail all on my own. I got a haircut not long after getting my Molly. There was something about her spirit, her tenacity, her patriotism, all those things were just so fascinating to me. And for me, it was a bridge to my mom, who was a doll collector, loved playing with dolls and dollware. So it was just kind of a whole new exciting chapter for me as a kid.
Now, I asked about your Molly origin stories to kind of demonstrate that there's a connection with American Girl dolls that I don't think we see with other lines. Mary, what is it about American Girl that can have that deep level of personal connection for the two of you and for so many of your podcast listeners?
Well, I think, you know, speaking for myself and for the stories that we've been lucky enough to collect from a lot of our listeners that are in the book, I think the design of the brand itself lent itself to that kind of lifelong connection. When Pleasant Roland invented American Girl, she dreamed of the dolls and the books together as something that would encourage girls to both see themselves at the center of the story and also to learn through play, to read the stories, but then reinforce it by playing with the dolls and the world of accessories. And she also saw this as something that would be passed down at a speech that she gave at Colonial Williamsburg at the launch of Felicity. She gives us really beautiful, offers these remarks about, you know, envisioning this being passed down kind of matrilineally from mother to daughter and so on. And we've lived long enough that we've actually seen that happen. We are not parents ourselves, but we have a lot of listeners who are kind of reinvigorated with the brand by getting the chance to share them with a whole new generation.
And Allison, I should point out in the podcast, in the book, you and Mary are fans clearly of American Girl. You're not boosters. You don't look at it without criticism. Can you talk about, you know, as you look back as a grown up to your childhood experience, some of the questions that were raised?
Yeah, I think we've joked on the podcast that we're not in the pocket of big doll, so to speak, that you know, we have enough distance from these things, both by aging and having some time away. You know, I collect dolls actively now, along with accessories, but that's something I didn't do for a period of time. So I was able to kind of revisit the stories, revisit my collection, go back to this idea of collecting. And I think having criticism of things that you once loved is really good. It's a positive thing to do. We've never marketed this as a purely nostalgic trip down memory lane, because we're really curious in what adults think about these things now and how new generations are interpreting them.
Talking to Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney, authors of the new book, Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. You can follow their podcast, Dolls of Our Lives, as well. We asked around Wisconsin Public Radio here for some memories of American Girl. Here's one of the responses we got.
This is Maureen McCollum, host of WPR's Wisconsin Life, and I am so happy to talk about my Kirsten doll. For those who don't know, Kirsten was one of the original American Girl dolls. She was a Swedish immigrant. Her family moved to the prairies of Minnesota sometime in the 1800s. And the Kirsten doll itself was one of my most treasured fancy possessions. My Aunt Mo gifted her to me when I was maybe 5 or 6. And then every Christmas or birthday, my aunt would send me another outfit or a little accessory to go with my Kirsten doll. And I actually just recently unearthed my Kirsten doll, pulled her out of a box, smelled super musty, but the dresses and the doll itself, like this wave of emotions came over me. Just this love for this doll returned and remembering how special she was. It's a feeling that just hasn't gone away over all these years.
Mary, can you talk? I'm guessing you've heard that from a lot of your podcast listeners, that personal connection, as Maureen said, after all those years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such a powerful thing. I've heard stories like that so many times and obviously have experienced that myself. And, you know, what's really interesting is as she was talking, I was laughing because Allison and I had no memory of the stories of those books before we reread them on the show. And yet we could swear to anyone that they were so formative, not only to us as people, but of our choice to become historians. Like, for example, spoiler alert, Kirsten's best friend dies en route, you know, on their journey out west from cholera. And it's extremely tragic and traumatic for many people, apparently not us, because we had no memory of that before we sat down to reread those books.
And Allison, that is a common theme in a lot of these books. There are pretty traumatic situations that a lot of these doll-based characters face in their stories.
Yeah, the authors who were chosen by first, you know, Pleasant Rolland with her early company, you know, she came out of a background of education and media. And even the most recent authors, you know, perhaps most notably Britt Bennett, these are people who care a lot about telling great stories with children and for children. So they're not shying away from difficult topics. And we hear so often from people that this was the first time they really learned something real about a topic such as slavery. Even the books that take us to the War of 1812, a largely forgotten chapter in US history, they give us kind of these harrowing incidents where kids are doing things we don't expect. I don't know that we want to encourage children to be part of, you know, cannonball smuggling schemes, but we can all be proud, right, of a girl who frees herself from slavery. So they really give you a spectrum to dive into.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Lyon. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Liz?
I agree with both of you. I loved Molly because I couldn't get any information out of my grandfather. He refused to speak about his service in World War II, and I was obsessed with it at a young age.
And I think we lost Liz, but I think our producer, she's getting to the point that the books gave her some of that background. Mary, that reminds me, I think it was you talking about your grandma in the book where the Molly books were, even though she didn't read them, as I recall, the Molly books gave you a lot of conversation starters to talk about her life in the, I think, the Depression and World War II eras.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, my grandmother, like it sounds like Liz's grandfather, didn't really want to talk about that period in her life voluntarily because it was a tough period of her life. There was a lot of privation and challenges. But because I could use the language of the Molly books, she really, you know, did satisfy my curiosity, and I learned so much about her that I probably wouldn't otherwise have known. And my own grandfather served in the war as well, and he passed away before I was born. So these books also are a way for me to invite her to share with me, you know, things about the life of a person I would never get to meet. So that was, you know, really special and important.
Thanks a lot for that call, Liz. Sorry we lost you at 800-642-1234. Michelle joins us now in Janesville. Michelle, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that as an elementary teacher, I incorporated the Felicity series into my third grade classroom, and we did a whole unit study on the American Revolution using Felicity as our main source.
Interesting. And did the kids respond to that, Michelle?
You know, even like the girls were having an American Girl craze at that point mm-hmm. in time, but the boys really enjoyed the historical part of it. We found an interactive website that I pulled up on the smart board. We did crafting projects. We did cooking. It was a great resource for us to use.
Michelle, thanks a lot for that call. The girl and boy thing reminds me, was it you, Allison? I can't remember, where you would be read to and the brothers in the family didn't want to have anything to do with this because it's a girl, but wait, they keep showing up to hear the books being read out loud.
That's
Mary's brother.
That was Mary. I'm sorry.
That's my
okay.
brothers. Yeah, no, that's okay. But yeah, they avowedly said it wasn't for them. It was girl stuff. But then one by one, they would join us. And we really all love those books together.
Thanks a lot for that call. And the idea of this as part of a teaching tool, Allison, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what's so great about that phone call is in the Felicity books and any of these series, you see kids having a really important role in history. So kids are active agents, and they're not just experiencing something of the past, but they're going out, and sometimes they're doing things that maybe we're not so sure about as adults looking back. That's what creates some of the comedy and tension. But I think for any kind of kid to see that children experience the revolution in a certain way, that's something they're probably really not likely to get in textbooks. And, you know, I talk about child labor with kids almost every day at my job, and hearing about kids in history can sometimes still be a novel thing.
Thanks again for that call, Michelle, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks. They are co-hosts of the podcast Dolls of Our Lives. Their new book is called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story to share about American Girl dolls in your own life or maybe a family member? Do you have questions for our guests about some of what they've explored in their podcast or the new book? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks, co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast, co-authors of a new book by the same name that explores the cultural impact, nostalgia, and more surrounding the American Girl brand of dolls. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts, your experiences with American Girl. Join in at 800-642-1234 as a kid, as a parent, maybe as an employee of the company. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Again, we asked our WPR colleagues to share stories. Our own Rochelle Wilson had a deep cut to share.
So I have an American Girl's deep cut. I used to play the American Girl's premiere, an educational computer game that came on a CD-ROM back in the 90s. Basically, you could play with different American Girl characters and create these little stage plays on the computer with your own dialogue and movements. And my sisters and I loved to put little plays together. And it was just one of the ways that I connected with American Girl.
Mary, it's not just the books and dolls. And in the book, you write about people taking it further, using social media now to do, in effect, their own fan fiction types of videos. How much have people taken the original premises and run with them?
Well, you could say people are living out loud. They're taking a lot of latitude, and I'm here for it. You might imagine it as a kind of fan fiction or just kind of a re-engagement with the brand to, in some cases, you know, reignite that nostalgia you have for a childhood love of the brand, like the the computer game, or to kind of incorporate more representation into a character story that you wish had been there at the start. So there's Instagram accounts like Lesbian Kirsten that argues just that, that Kirsten was a lesbian and or is a lesbian, I should say, and, you know, just creates representation around that. There's a lot of great interpreter or living history accounts that imagine this. And new kinds of stories. There's so much there, and it's really beautiful. There's we just had the photographer Sydney Paulson on our show. Her account is at Five Hens and Cockatiels on Instagram, and she works with the brand directly, doing stage photographs with the dolls, recreating movie scenes, and also of course scenes from the brand. So a lot of really interesting stuff out there.
Allison, something I wanted to get into before we run out of time is American Girl dolls and their connection with race and representation of people from different backgrounds. Can you talk a little bit about how that's evolved over the decades?
We've had, you know, really the privilege of a lot of people reaching out to us and sharing their stories, which are different from our own. And there's been some really fantastic think pieces. Aisha Harris has written extensively about the meaning of the Addie doll and her connections both to slavery and self-liberation. I think what has been really fascinating about doing the show is we get to be kind of this listening space. You know, you imagine a podcast as projecting out, but we hear so much from people who have these completely varied relationships with characters such as Josefina or Courtney or Kirsten. And the doll might be a kind of mirror for them in some way, or it might be a window to exploring something else, or they may have decided that it's too fraught, a relationship with a certain character. And so they've chosen to no longer own that doll or to do something different with it. So, you know, I think from think pieces to decisions people make about their own closets and their own collections, adults are generally really thoughtful about how they engage with American Girl.
Listeners can find a link to a Central Time conversation with Aisha Harris about the Addie doll at WPR.org. Just search our archives. We are talking to Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks. Their new book is called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. Back to your calls now. Janine is with us in Madison. Janine, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about Janine?
We were very lucky, and my mother-in-law worked for the Pleasant Company when Pleasant owned it. And all of her granddaughters received dolls that were signed by Pleasant. So cherished dolls through our family.
Wow, Janine, that is fantastic. Do you still have yours, I should ask?
Well, it's actually my daughter's.
Your daughter's,
and
I'm sorry, yes.
We still have it in box because we're like, she had a whole bunch of other Pleasant Company dolls because she played with those. The signed one stayed in the box. But she was a very lucky girl because she grew up getting Pleasant Company paraphernalia for many years.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, Janine. Yeah, and we've heard some other stories of people, you know, when they have sales by the company locally in the Wisconsin area, having memories of finding those. Mary, the idea of the American Girl dolls as collector items, it seems like most people didn't just leave them in boxes. Do I have that wrong?
No, I mean, I think there's both. Allison's probably better to comment on this as a fellow collector, but I think they're both very well loved, but then some do actually keep them in pristine condition. So Allison, are yours more actively loved or do you keep yours in boxes?
Gosh, none of my dolls have seen a box since the day that they arrived on my front step. I was the same way with my Barbies, and from my family level, the play was always encouraged. And there are folks who say, gosh, you know, I wish I had really kept this more pristine. You know, you can always buy, someone is always willing to sell it, right, for some amount, but you can never get back the time that you enjoy playing with them. So that's how I rationalize having ruined a number of my dolls.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
And the price of the American Girl dolls is something you tackle in the book a little bit. It's a barrier to entry for some people that raises some concerns, I think. Mary, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a very real concern. I think Pleasant at the time would say that when American Girl debuted, she said, you know, a Nintendo game system costs far more than an American Girl doll and the books. So, you know, this is not a fair critique, but I think for many families and people, you know, these dolls were beyond reach. And a lot of listeners have shared with us that this was sometimes occasioned the first real conversations they had about money as a family when they would ask for a doll for a birthday. And, you know, it was just not in the budget. And some fans grew up as adults, you know, with the dream of buying a doll for themselves, even as, you know, folks who aren't parents, just to kind of like as a kind of wish fulfillment of a childhood wish. But I do think that those class barriers are real and, you know, definitely something that endures with the brand.
Allison, something I got to ask. Now, sometimes when I go back and read a cherished book from my youth, sometimes it's great. Sometimes it doesn't hold up. What was the experience like of picking up these books that you'd read and, as Mary mentioned earlier, mostly forgotten? Was it fun to read them again?
Oh, they're definitely fun to reread. I think Molly was probably the hardest because we have, you know, just romanticized certain ideas and qualities about her. And there are pages where you're just so reminded as a reader in your 30s that she's nine, you know, or she's 10 years old and she's grappling with things. She and I still have a lot in common. Like, we won't eat turnips, you know, that's like an early Molly reference. But the truth is, it's a lot of fun to revisit these things. I think if you go in with an open mind, right, and you're willing to see how the text hasn't changed, but you have, and that can be a great experience.
We'll leave it there. Allison and Mary, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney are historians and co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast. We've been talking about the cultural legacy of the Wisconsin-based American Girl brand and their new book, Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. You can keep sharing your stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are many scams out there that can come to us on a phone call, a text, an email, or a website. We'll get some of the latest advice on how to stay safe with the state's top consumer protection office. And there are fewer people in the average Wisconsin household these days. That's creating a mismatch in our housing market. Find out what that means for your living situation now and in the future. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the director of the new UW-Madison Center for Interfaith Dialogue about how to talk about contentious religious issues like the war in Gaza with people who have different faith backgrounds than our own. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The conflict between Israel and Hamas can be difficult to talk about, and it's especially sensitive for people with a connection to the region. Many people of Jewish and Muslim faith in the United States are feeling the pain of that war on the other side of the planet, and it could shape how they view the conflict and the parties involved. It can make it harder for us to have conversations about contentious issues like this one, especially with people who have different beliefs than our own. A new center on the UW-Madison campus is working to bridge those religious divides and promote better cooperation and understanding. We're learning more about how to have better, more productive dialogue with people of different religious backgrounds. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How often do you interact with people of different faiths than your own? Have you talked to friends or acquaintances about this Israel-Hamas war? How have those conversations gone? Do you have questions about how to have those kind of difficult conversations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ulrich Rosenhagen is the interim director of the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison and an ordained Lutheran pastor. Ulrich, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, glad to be here.
First of all, can you tell us about this still relatively new Center for Interfaith Dialogue? What kind of things are part of your mission?
Well, it is new and it is not that new. I'm doing interreligious work on campus for 16 years with different centers. But it's new now because it moved from the College of Letters and Science to Student Affairs. And the emphasis is now different of the interfaith work with the new center. Previously, the first center was the Luba Institute for the Study of the Abrahamic Religions. The second one was the Center for Religion and Global Citizenry, and now it's the Center for Interfaith Dialogue.
What kind of things do you do to try to convene interfaith dialogue, to bring people together and have hopefully civil conversations, even with people of different faith and other backgrounds?
Yeah, the core of the center is a student community. It's a group of students whom we call interfaith fellows, and they work closely with me for the full academic year. And the program I developed over the years has different stages. So it's actually very much the same every year, kind of the way it's designed. The first phase is that students come, get to know each other, build relationships, develop trust. We give ourselves a set of rules. In the second phase, students learn from each other. So it's the what I call the religious literacy phase. We talk about core values, core convictions, stories, sacred stories from our traditions. We explain practices, holidays. We come together over potluck, etc. The third phase then is that we experience as an interfaith community. We experience different things. We go to different places of worship. We go on a silent retreat, an overnight retreat, where we explore contemplative traditions. And then the students, the interfaith fellows, also organize program on campus and then actually execute that. So that's part of the learning process, that they're able then to facilitate dialogue and organize dialogue on campus.
After going through a process like that, do you find that people of different faith backgrounds come away feeling more positively about each other, or better able to communicate with people who are from different traditions than their own?
Well, I hear from students who have gone through the program and are out now 5, 10, 12 years, that the program always has helped them when they graduate and then start a professional life. They always help them to work in groups, in the workplace, in a corporate setting, because, you know, wherever we are living in diverse communities. And a piece of that program is that you learn how to negotiate difference. You learn, or you realize, you don't have to be the same. You can come from very different ends of the spectrum, and then you discover what you have in common, what you share, and also where you disagree. And you do this in a very respectful way, so that different things my fellows learn, different things they reflect upon. And the feedback I receive from my, if you will, my alumni is very, very good. So they always say that they benefited enormously from the program.
Talking to Ulrich Rosenhagen with the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison, talking about having conversations, including about difficult issues among people of different faith backgrounds. Ulrich, the center's Faith Advisory Council released a statement last week about First Amendment speech on Israel and Palestine, urging the public to, quote, speak freely but with humility, end quote, and to act strongly but do not harm. Can you talk a little bit about what you hope people take away from the message, that message, as we have this very divisive, in many cases, debate here in the United States?
Well, obviously, at a public university, First Amendment rights are very important. But I think we tend to forget that what is legally allowed, or what is our right based on the Constitution, needs to be kind of embedded in a set of values, in some form of moral imagination. And that's basically what we try to express in this statement, that we don't have to always insist on this right, or when we speak, when we make use of the right to express ourselves, the right to free speech, we may harm other people. So we have to be respectful in the community we live. We have to recognize the the taken to regard how our words can harm other people. And that is something I think that council we have at the center expressed in a beautiful way, I think, emphasizing that we respect each other and we have to be mindful of the way we conduct ourselves when we use our freedom of speech.
And that statement actually cites religious documents from Islam, Judaism, and Christianity that point toward that ability to have that kind of civil conversation. Can you talk about how we can find that call in different religious traditions?
Well, I think that all great religious traditions share things like the dignity of the individual, the sanctity of human life, ideas of justice, of compassion. That is, I mean, across the board, you go from one tradition to the next, and our sacred texts, our sacred rituals express this, remind us of this, and also give us a story where we can place ourselves in. And because it's an interfaith council, because we have several different traditions, we wanted to express this. We wanted to show, we wanted to say, we draw in our respect for the other, in our humility when we speak and use our right to express ourselves. And this humility, we draw on our sacred texts, on our religious traditions. And we find this, you pointed at the three examples we mentioned in the statement. We wanted to say this is not just one tradition. And we share this. And though we are different, though we disagree on issues, though we worship differently, we have deeply held beliefs we all have in common.
A lot of the interactions we see, especially in the news, are protest and counter-protest, or people from with different perspectives, say on Israel and Hamas and the Palestinians on different sides. Obviously, it can be very heated. People may have genuine and well-founded grievances coming from any of those perspectives. In that kind of situation, without that, I think, safety of an interfaith group like yours, how can we, I don't know, turn down the heat a little bit to recognize each other's, to hear each other's arguments?
Well, first of all, I think you have to have a community where you do this, where you have to have an interfaith community. So you need to have friends, classmates who come from a different tradition. And then you hope that the bonds you have built over time, the relationships you have built, are strong enough that even in a moment of crisis, they don't break apart. Then I guess you also share the grief in those groups. I mean, in my current student group, so I have Sikhs, Hindu, variety of Christian, Jewish and Muslim. And their stories following the conflict are very personal and very traumatizing. So you want to have relationships where you can still sit and listen, and be careful, be mindful of the trauma, the shock the other experienced. So it's the creation of small groups that are together and willing to listen to each other, and in situations of crisis, which I think is something very helpful.
We're talking to Ulrich Rosenhagen from the UW-Madison Center for Interfaith Dialogue about how to have healthy, productive conversations with people of different faiths than our own, even when it comes to controversial and divisive topics like Israel and Palestine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done some kind of interfaith work, maybe in your own community? Do you have friends or family members of different religious backgrounds? How do you talk to each other about those different faith traditions? And what kind of conversations have you had with people in your life about the conflict in Gaza? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ulrich Rosenhagen, Interim Director of the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison, talking today about how to talk about topics, including controversial topics like the conflict between Israel and Hamas. When we're talking to people of different faith backgrounds, he says we need to create communities of people getting to know each other, getting to understand each other. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you, in a formal way or maybe in an informal way, had these kind of dialogues in your life with people of different faith groups? Do you work in community groups that bring together people from different backgrounds like that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Minocqua. Mike, hello.
Hi, Rob. Just wondering, you know, worldviews do come into opposing positions. And so if it's something really important, say the Judeo-Christian perspective based on biblical teaching that the Jewish people have a right to the land that they're in now, as opposed to maybe Arabic and Islamic traditions and faith teaching that would be opposed to that. So if we have two views that are in direct opposition to one another, either one's right and the other's wrong, or they're both wrong, and how do we have a conversation when we're in a situation like that?
Mike, interesting question. Ulrich, what do you think?
Well, I usually try to avoid these absolute truth questions. This one is right and one is wrong. I tend to think that once you look closer, things are always more complex than they seem at first sight. For Israel, I mean, it's a phrase people use is it's two people, three religions, and they all somehow belong there and have relations and histories that are deeply entwined and with the land. Historically, they are different, the narratives are entwined. So I don't like these either or questions, and I don't believe that we can have reality that's sanitized, if you will, that's separated by this is right and this is wrong. In fact, I used to quote a text to my students that I like a lot by a Brett Hirschfield, who used to be part of the settler movement and then returned to the U.S. And the book is titled, "You Don't Have to Be Right for Me to Be Wrong." So the idea is that two things can be true at the same time, and the title expresses that. I think we need to learn that different things can be right, maybe true at the same time.
Mike, thanks for the call. I always think back, Ulrich, to Europe in the 15 and 1600s, where if you asked people, is it possible for Protestants and Catholics to live in the same country peacefully? I think the answer would for those of them be no. Obviously, things have managed to change since then. So sometimes, hopefully, seemingly intractable oppositions, as Mike is suggesting there, can get resolved over time.
Well, that's the hope. That's the vision. And I actually think that interfaith dialogue can help us with this. I think that religion, at least the way I make sense of the different religious traditions, they can coexist. They can be both true. What's true for me is not necessarily true for someone else. And we have to learn this. I think that's the big challenge in the 21st century. Living in a diverse America, living in religious pluralism, that means we have to learn that we coexist. And the beautiful piece is when we discover what we have in common, the mutuality religious traditions share. And that's, I think that's the process we are in, if you will, historically speaking.
Talking to Ulrich Rosenhagen with the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison, talking about how to promote dialogue between people of different faith backgrounds. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to another caller now. Anne is with us in Milwaukee. Anne, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just would like to make a point, or maybe ask your guests if you could comment on the fact that Judaism is not Zionism. And it seems to me that both Zionism and Israel have cloaked themselves in a mantle of Judaism to deflect criticism of the Zionist ideology of occupation in the political state of Israel.
And thanks for the call, Ulrich. I don't know if you want to weigh in on the distinction Anne is making, but is it easy when we try to have interfaith dialogue to get caught up in how we define ourselves, how we define others along the lines that Anne's talking about?
Yeah, and I'm certainly not an expert on what is Zionism. And I mean, it started out as a utopian movement in 19th century Europe. Today, my students, some students have a very different idea of what it means. I think interfaith dialogue helps us to create a space where we can kind of define or figure out what are our definitions. How do we make sense of certain terms that are buzzing around? And so it's helpful to listen to each other and hear when we use a word like Zionism, what do you mean by this? And that might not be the same I mean when using that term. So what I'm doing on campus certainly creates a space that we can wrestle with these definitions and hopefully come out with a better and bigger understanding of each other.
And thanks a lot for the call. Ulrich, this kind of interfaith work you're doing sounds like a good setting for people to get to know each other and a safe space, if you will, to have these kind of conversations in a productive way. A lot of times, again, I keep coming back to when two people meet each other at a protest from different sides or run into each other online, often they're complete strangers. There is no community between them in some ways. What would you ask people to keep in their minds in that situation where they may be escalating a conversation, a dispute with someone that they don't even know?
Well, I'm in a slightly better position because my center is a UW-Madison center. So I have a community. Mm-hmm. I have a campus community. And students know that although they're different and they come from different religious traditions, they traffic in different student communities, in the end, we are all in this together as a campus community. I think the statement and appealed in its essence, appealed to people, even if you express your free speech, and make sure not to do harm. So that's, we have to be careful that our conversations don't turn into heated arguments and then escalate even further. I think it with my fellows, I hope, or my idea, my hope is that my interfaith fellows can be on campus at least, something like ambassadors at large who can facilitate conversation and can get between people before the situation escalates. And so we have to contain ourselves. I think we also have to remember that there is moral values, a moral imagination, if you will, that needs to go along with us using the First Amendment. We have to be mindful the way words and actions resonate on with someone of a different opinion from a different group. And we kind of anticipate this and don't let things escalate. I think interfaith dialogue can teach you this, because it's you're in a diverse group of students, a diverse group of people, and that's what we are on campus, and that's what we are in America. We are in this as a diverse community, and be mindful of that, and that I think will help.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Happy to be here.
That's Ulrich Rosenhagen, Interim Director of the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison, with us to share how we could have better conversations about sometimes controversial topics with people who have different faiths than our own. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.